Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 73. It's August 8th, 2020. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. We had everything before us. We had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven. We were all going direct the other way. In short, the period was so far like the present period that some of its noisiest authorities insisted on its being received, for good or for evil, in the superlative degree of comparison only. That's obviously the first paragraph of Dickens and A Tale of Two Cities. And, you know, it just strikes me that it's written in 1859, I think, and here we are in 2020, and there's just an incredible amount of opportunity in front of all of us if we can just get a grip and keep our eye on it and get to work. And at the same time, there's tremendous amounts of chaos and change, and ever it shall be, I suppose, though it's a heady time to be alive. And this is one of the most sort of poetic presentations of the idea of paradoxes, that these seeming contradictory ideas can both be true at the same time. And I just thought of this. This isn't the only reading today, by the way. I'm going to try an experiment here. I over the weekend, thinking about Eddie and Sandra and the Threadgills auction and Threadgills going away. They announced months ago now that they will never serve food again. And Eddie had auctioned off a ton of his artifacts from the downtown Threadgills on Riverside. This last weekend, he just had an auction for everything in the North Threadgills, North Lamar. With that on my mind, I went into old piles of books and was thinking about Austin's past, and really recent past, so recent that the people in these stories, many of them are still walking around among us. They're here still, though basically they won't be for all that much longer. These are older people. These are events that were happening. They were sort of in their primes, if you will, in the 60s and 70s, really coming into their own. And it's the 2020s, and time marches on. Thankfully, a lot of them have captured their stories and written books, and so I was going through some of those. And I'd mentioned Bud Schrake and realized I don't know that much about him. So I was going to indexes and trying to find him. And, you know, there's a lot of talk these days about history, that we don't know our history. And there are definitely many important elements of recent history that we just don't know. And it's introduced the idea nationally that history can, in a sense, be weaponized. And it's important to know history. It's yet another paradox. It's important to know history, but if we spend too much time just reading history, we aren't doing anything today. This idea, though, that we might uniquely not know history, I don't buy. I think it's sort of universal. In fact, if we go back another reading today, here that I just wanted to cut through is a classic. It's in the Bible, actually. I'm going to read from the Bible here, from Ecclesiastes chapter 1. From King Solomon. And this is what it says. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit hath a man of all his labor, which he taketh under the sun? One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose. The wind goeth toward the south, and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth about continually. And the wind returneth again according to his circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. All things are full of labor, man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. The thing that hath been, it is that which shall be. And that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. Is there any thing whereof it may be said, see, this is new? It has been already of old time, which was before us. There is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come with those that shall come after. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I gave my heart to seek and search out wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. That which is crooked cannot be made straight. And that which is wanting cannot be numbered. I communed with my own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I gave my heart to know wisdom, and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is vexation of spirit. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. Ha. So, how's that for an uplifting, optimistic message? It's imparting a whole bunch there. There's a lot of punch. I'll leave it to you if you want to go read the rest of that particular book. And you know, the birds, the song, to everything, turn, turn, there's a season, time for war, time for peace, all of that, that comes from this book. The ideas here, though, that what we're living through now has happened before. It's going to happen again. And we can go accumulate all the knowledge we want. And it's a vanity. It's sorrow. Our labors are going to pour into the river. And the river will never be full. The river will keep flowing. This generation will pass away. Another one will come along, etc. So in general, though, the only reason it occurred to me here is it's sort of another paradox. The best of times, the worst of times. We should know our history. We should also be aware of how constant, how universal it is as a trap to not know it. And by the way, even if you decide to go know it, then you get into a gigantic epistemological fog. How do you know what the, quote, real history is? How do we know? I don't know about you, but these days, it's hard to even know the history of what happened yesterday. It's hard to take seriously any of the, quote, reporting about it. Because it's just such a clown show. So how do we know? Wendell Berry and many others, and from all kinds of different angles and perspectives, would say one thing we can definitely do is roll up our own sleeves, get a grip, as it were, and take care of ourselves, and then help take care of the person next to you, whoever they might be. And if enough people do that, it really moves the world. In reflecting on, like, just a name like Bud Schrag, I'm somebody who's theoretically into Austin history and books and Austin music and all this, and I there's so much that I don't know. It's an immense reservoir of stuff, and if I don't know this kind of thing, then it just occurs to me how much I don't know about this actor, that actor, you know, big historical pieces of legislation, wars, all manner of things. Here we are in Austin. We're losing a lot of our cultural places and connecting points. And recently, too, it's sort of been intoning in my mind, having read that bit from the Talent Code on how a place can serve as ignition to the people there to more or less summon forth skill development, real skill, and these the whispers of a place. When you see all of this happening around you, include better get busy, and also, hey, that could be you. And so it's just been on my mind, what is Austin whispering today? Who's whispering? You know, there's a lot of people shouting, but underneath it, what is really being whispered? And are there voices and really incredible difference makers that we still haven't discovered, even though they're right here in our midst? And the method to the madness here, as I plow through this, is obviously I'm just sort of more or less thinking out loud. I've been thinking a lot about this city and the opportunity we have in this city. Even more is coming. Just one thing from the news, this Tesla Gigafactory, it's coming. It's not here yet. It's on the way. And I'm trying to just be a little more aware of what's going on out there. And as I think about what's coming down the pike here with this regular stuff, sort of what's next. I went looking through some of these books, and I want to read a few passages just because I think they're absolutely kick-ass. But I also think they do evoke some of this stuff, and I hope that they serve for some of y'all in the same way, this better get busy, and hey, this could be you. So let me grab one of these and just start. This first one is from the very, very beginning of Jason Mellard's Progressive Country. He's basically an academic, like a scholar, interested in Texas, the idea of the Texan. And so here we go. This is how his book begins. In March 1975, Atlantic Monthly devoted an entire issue to Texas. The magazine intended it to open a series highlighting American spaces for the coming bicentennial. However, apart from a shorter story on the Pacific Northwest months later, this issue on a single state stood alone. The editors chose Texas for its evocative, even polarizing qualities, the sense of it as a place that some who know love to hate, and many who have been shaped by it Hate to Love. In 18 articles over 100 pages, William Broyles, David Broder, T.R. Fehrenbach, John Graves, Molly Ivins, Barbara Jordan, Larry L. King, Larry McMurtry, Catherine Ann Porter, Al Reinert, Jack Valenti, Richard West, and others explored the notion of Texans' perceived difference from the rest of the nation, tacking between its mythologized frontier past and its swaggering Sunbelt modernity. The juxtaposition of the two, in the national imagination and in the lives of Texas residents, made for intriguing moments in the 1970s. The process rendered Texas and the notion of Texanness an interpretive key to American culture and politics in the years following the end of the long post-World War II economic boom. This book uses that key to understand better the relationships between region and nation, place and identity in the late 20th century. One evening in December 1972, for example, two singer-songwriters stood backstage at the Armadillo World Headquarters nightclub in Austin. They knew each other from their time together in Nashville until one of them left, frustrated with his uncertain prospects as star material in Music City. The defector had recently moved to Austin. Soon thereafter, he called the Texan still in exile to let him know that he had found something down here, which is why they were backstage at the Armadillo. The two had played any number of dubious honky-tonks and dance halls across the country, but preparing to take the stage after a raucous country rock act named Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen, and peering out a screaming crowd of long-haired cosmic cowboys and peasant-bloused honky-tonk angels, Waylon Jennings just was not sure what to make of it all. He turned to his friend, visibly worried. "What the hell have you got me into, Willie?" No wonder the currents coursing through that audience surprised Jennings. Texas in the 1970s portended at various times the boosterism of an energy-led Sunbelt future in Houston and Dallas, the activist democracy of a post-Anglo majority in San Antonio and Crystal City, the rise of a new creative class born of the counterculture in Austin, and, in a few exemplary moments, a full-blown cultural renaissance that enveloped the state as a whole. These developments dovetailed with an ongoing statewide fascination with the very quality of Texanness and its purportedly special position within the 1970s United States. As Eddie Wilson, founder of the Armadillo World Headquarters, stated the case in introducing Willie Nelson during the televised Armadillo Country Music Review in 1973, "There's a story going around the United States of America. Going around about the same time that the government's crumbling and that economics are falling apart and the prices are going up. And the story is that there's something weird going on in Austin, Texas. And what seems to be weird is the cowboys and the hippies are getting along better, probably than anywhere in the world. And maybe it's because the cowboys took a look at the hippies a couple of days ago and said, 'They look more like my grandfather than I do.'" This narrative of the coming together of the hippies and the cowboys, more commonly parsed as the hippies and the rednecks, took quick root and signified an attempted coming to terms with the oppositions of urban and rural, modern and traditional, and the politico-cultural valences of left and right in the 1970s. In all, the capital city of Austin provided some of the best illustrations for the decade's substantive fascination with an attempted revision of the Texan. Artists, writers, and entrepreneurs there often fed the projection of a Texas chic for national audiences in a period of political and economic malaise, reinventing the discursive possibilities of the bountiful frontier in an era otherwise marked by America's discovery of its distinct limitations. First page and a half of Progressive Country. And, Willie, what have you gotten me into? it's incredible. It's sort of just everywhere, the lore of outlaw country and Willie and Waylon leaving Nashville, coming to Austin, and I'm now more than 100 pages into this same book, Jason Mellard's Progressive Country, and I'm going to read just basically a page here. What does outlaw signify in this context? Though the 1976 album's themes continued the decade's musical elaboration of cowboy masculinity, these artists focused on those elements of the mythos that stress the cowboy's singular moral authority outside the law of the community. Country music's outlaw pose fit the 70s, a musically performative variant of the outlaw antihero that dominated the decade's best cinema. The outlaw stance drew on the general mistrust of established institutions inherited from the 60s and ratcheted to new levels through the Watergate scandal. From the films Dog Day Afternoon to Taxi Driver to Network to Dirty Harry, individuals who operated outside the bounds and against the strictures of bureaucratic institutions spoke to a broad anti-authoritarianism that often transcended traditional political labels of left and right. Country outlaws absorbed both countercultural flair and hard hat reaction to make their point and their record sales. And it is this breadth in part that accounts for the musical subgenre's meteoric success. As far as Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, and the Texas Music Contingent were concerned, the outlaw pose served three ends. First, as with the Cosmic Cowboy, the outlaw was a performative guise that successfully drew on the decade's populist anti-authoritarianism, discourses of authenticity, and libidinal charge. Dallas Cowboys tight end turned novelist Peter Gint spoofed the shift from progressive to outlaw styles, even as he acknowledged its appeal with the character Willie Roy Rogers in Texas Celebrity Turkey Trot. Willie Roy's act sure had changed. Instead of smiling, sleepy-eyed, melancholy drunk, he was a strutting, threatening bad guy. God, I love being an outlaw, Willie Roy grinned. These people need me to do their feeling. They love outlaws. I don't put up with any of it. I do and say what I want. I tell it like it is. I'm just mean, and I feel wonderful. This meanness, in part, differentiated the outlaw style from the progressive one that directly preceded it. Second, the outlaw provided an aesthetic that, while claiming a return to authentic honky-tonk roots in its music, also cemented the country rock crossover from bases in Austin and Nashville. James Salapsky's documentary, Heartworn Highways, of 1975, which is incredible, by the way. Everybody, y'all should go watch Heartworn Highways. It demonstrates the hybridities well. For all its paeans to the country life, as represented by the depiction of Townes Van Zandt with his dogs, chickens, and guns, he's standing in Clarksville, by the way, the film's musical performances by the likes of Charlie Daniels and David Allan Coe demonstrated the blending of country styles with rock tempos, theatrics, and volume. The third and final element of the outlaw pose involved a declaration of independence, not only from Nashville's smooth pop country-politan sound, but also from the Nashville seat of production itself. Outlaw, in this sense, signified a rebellion against country's means of production, along Music Row, building a cultural apparatus outside the law of the Nashville studio system. To this end, Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings exerted greater control over their creative work, looking to producers in New York, Los Angeles, and Austin, employing their own touring bands in the studio, and participating more heavily in management decisions. Nelson went so far as to construct an alternate infrastructure for recording country music under artist control in Austin, with the venue, the Austin Opera House, and his own Lone Star Records imprint for Columbia as its center. Pretty cool stuff there. You know, just a little bit about Willie Waylon, a little more about that. But also, you know, with the style of an academic, with the work and the expertise of an academic, you know, he's talking about big cultural ideas and political movements and sort of situating these musicians, these are just two guys playing guitar and writing songs, situating them in all of that, is fascinating stuff. And of course, I don't know about you, but you know, Willie and Waylon going from Austin to Nashville and taking creative control and all of this, and not being allowed to perform, and not being, you know, even the whole thing of long-haired hippies getting their asses kicked in Texas, all over Texas. The story yesterday of Bud Schrake with his long hair putting on a cowboy hat so he can safely disappear into the populace. I almost know nothing of hip hop, but it does make me want to go read about its history. That's an entire movement of artists grabbing creative control and like Willie and Waylon, frankly, becoming incredibly entrepreneurial and, taking big risks creatively and financially, and then it's worth saying just becoming fantastically wealthy. Like some of these folks, from say Willie to Jay-Z, they're empire builders, really. And they just don't accept the terms of what's put in front of them. A little more on Bud Schrake and the Armadillo and Willie and all of this comes from Eddie Wilson's memoir called Armadillo World Headquarters. And I couldn't recommend the book more highly. Eddie's an incredible storyteller. And even here, not hearing him in his own voice, which is amazing, he should really, I wish he would do an audiobook and read the whole thing himself. And then just riff about it. This is Eddie setting up a little bit about before the Armadillo even came into being. And I think it's also really interesting to read this because Eddie, to his credit, is not trying to claim authorship or invention over Austin music or even this hippies and rednecks thing. It happened there, and the Armadillo was vitally important. But I think part of the reason Eddie was able to be that person was because he appreciates what has come before. He's frustrated. He's frustrated at the time with what's going on. He's still frustrated today with what's going on politically and economically. But he was an individual. He was the right person at the right time for all of us benefiting downstream from him because he respected what was coming before. He is a historian. He puts all of us to shame. Eddie Wilson is an incredible historian and archivist, just as in his person. And so I'll pick up here. This is Eddie. Before the Armadillo, I had zero experience running a music club. I was 26 years old, and my post-college experience included serving a stint in the Marine Corps, teaching school, coaching football, lobbying for the Brewers Association, and spending a couple extended sojourns in Zihuatanejo, Mexico, looking for Timothy Leary. In the months leading up to July 1970, I had assumed the job of band manager for a country folky hippie group, Shiva's Headband. Their sound was rooted in folk and country music, but featured extended, trance-like jams powered by the band leader's untamed electric violin. I got the job mostly because I was the only person band leader Spencer Perskin knew who owned a suit and tie. Shiva's Headband was the only band in Austin that had a recording contract with a major label. Capitol Records had made a deal with Perskin in which he was advanced funds not only to create a debut album, but to seek out and develop other similar bands in the Austin area. Despite sounding like big business, my initial task for the band was a humble yet difficult mission: find a place in town where they could gig for a few hundred dollars a night, ASAP. For the past few years, Shiva's had been the house band at the Vulcan Gas Company. It's hard to imagine now, but this hippie hangout was located downtown at 316 Congress Avenue, just a few blocks from the state capitol. The walls were plastered with Dayglo art, bathed in black lights, and it had an in-house psychedelic light show. After opening in 1967, the Vulcan booked local and regional bands like Shiva's Headband, The Conqueror, Georgetown Medical Band, and Bubble Puppy. veteran Texas bluesmen like Mance Lipscomb and Lightnin' Hopkins, and touring acts that ordinarily wouldn't have passed through Austin. The Vulcan hosted shows that were landmarks in Austin music history. Muddy Waters' two-night stand, August 2nd, 3rd, 1968, was one of them. The opening act was Johnny Winter, the lightning-fast, gravel-voiced, albino blues guitarist from Beaumont. Johnny was 24 years old and had been touring and recording since he was a teenager. Muddy and his touring band were impressed as hell with him. Although they pulled into Austin feeling jaded and fatigued from traveling and turned in less than stellar performances the first night, the Chicago bluesmen ratcheted up their show on the second night, and Muddy struck up a lifelong friendship with Johnny. Backed by his white-hot rhythm section, bassist Tommy Shannon, who became, by the way, part of Double Trouble with Stevie Ray, bassist Tommy Shannon and drummer Uncle John Turner, Johnny Winter recorded the iconic album Progressive Blues Experiment at the Vulcan that same year. One reason the record has such a great live sound is that during the recording, a microphone was hung down into an old cistern behind the building, capturing the great underground reverb sound. When Johnny signed with Columbia Records in 1969, the six-figure deal was the largest ever offered to a solo artist. The 13th Floor Elevators is another famous band closely associated with the Vulcan. The first band to use the term psychedelic to describe its music, the Elevators exploded onto the Austin music scene in late 1965 with its first single, You're Gonna Miss Me. The band electrified club audiences with its soaring blend of garage rock, surf rock, and blues, a mix that became truly mind-bending with the addition of electric jug player Tommy Hall and singer Rocky Erickson. Rocky, an 18-year-old dropout from Travis High, sang with the swagger of Mick Jagger and the raw sex howls of James Brown and Wilson Pickett. The Elevators not only coined the term psychedelic for the genre. Sorry, getting past a whole 12 pages of pictures. Wait. Hang on here. They went out to San Francisco. And blew the minds of the top bands in the Bay Area. Those bands, Jefferson Airplane, The Grateful Dead, and Moby Grape, to name a few, were so impressed with the Elevator psychedelic sound that they immediately began the process of psychedelicizing their own repertoire. The career arc of the 13th Floor Elevators could hardly have been more like a meteor burning brightly through the sky and crashing to earth in a zillion brilliant colors. The ingestion of large volumes of drugs, including LSD, mescaline, and speed, often on a daily basis, helped inspire and fuel the Elevator psychedelic sound, but it proved to be an unsustainable lifestyle. Rocky Erickson's drug use apparently exacerbated existing mental health problems that would not be correctly diagnosed for several decades. And in the Elevator's case, they didn't need drugs to be paranoid. Each member of the band had been under police surveillance since shortly after they played their first gig. Two of the primary Austin Police Department officers who carried out the surveillance and busts, Harvey Gann and Bert Gerding, repeatedly admitted in recent years that it was their intention to destroy drug bands and radical groups in Austin in the 60s. They were threatening my culture, said Gerding, and I liked my culture. Rocky was busted for a second time in 1969 for possession of a single joint. In an ill-advised ploy to avoid a long prison term, he pled insanity. He was incarcerated at Rusk State Hospital, and for the next 3 years was subjected to electroconvulsive therapy and Thorazine treatments. Instead of lending his genius to the rock and roll scene, he was playing in the Rusk State Hospital band, whose members included rapists and murderers. The Vulcan Gas Company had also been the roost for Austin's underground poster artists, thanks mostly to Gilbert Shelton, best known for creating the fabulous furry Freak Brothers and Wonder Warthog. Gilbert designed oversized posters for the Vulcan until he moved to San Francisco. His successor, Jim Franklin, not only carried on the tradition of featuring armadillos in his work, but brought it to a new level. In Franklin's hands, the humble, hard-shelled mammal was a portal to other dimensions, as well as a mirror reflection of our own identities. It's hard to explain the expectations we were dealing with when word got out that a new hippie music joint was about to open. There were many people in the community who missed the Vulcan Gas Company. The very existence of the place had given them hope. It was part of their identity. Sadly, the Vulcan was a money pit for Don Hyde, and he'd only kept it running for as long as he had because he believed in the music and art scene that it served. The Vulcan Gas Company might have been a dump, but it's a very important part of Austin music history. Don Hyde lived the story, so he was gracious enough to lend a few words, giving an inside point of view. And this bit is a letter given to Eddie for this book from Don Hyde. The club always lost money. The Monday after the second weekend we were open, I was informed that the Austin American Statesman would no longer run advertising for the Vulcan Gas Company, nor would any reviews be printed. Before long, we realized that the 13th floor elevators would not be our house band. In fact, they were on a tragic downhill slide. It was a major blow to us, as no other local band could draw more than 100 people. We had to take chances, so we started booking big-name bands. I booked Canned Heat, the Steve Miller Band, Moby Grape, and the Fugs. Working with Al Smith, I was able to book the Chicago blues greats, John Lee Hooker, Muddy Waters, Jimmy Reed, Big Joe Williams, and Big Mama Thornton. Houston White, a Delta blues aficionado, booked Sleepy John Estes, Fred McDowell, and Lightnin' Hopkins. Johnny Winter came and honed his act for a year, then signed a massive deal. Columbia. We had some great shows, some of which made history, like the Velvet Underground. Some of them made money, others did not. Most of the time we lost money, and I was the person who threw money at the club to keep it afloat. There were four partners when the Vulcan opened in 1967, Gary Maxwell, Houston White, Sandy Lockett, and myself. Gary and Houston had already produced some San Francisco-type shows in Austin and Houston, operating under the name Electric Grandmother. For Austin shows, they were renting the Doris Miller Auditorium, but the place was impractical for a lot of reasons, one being that the acoustics were horrible. My search for a venue led me to the funky Victorian storefront at 316 Congress Avenue. I made a handshake deal with the owner, Joe Darcy, an elderly Lebanese merchant I'd known since childhood. Gilbert Shelton created our logo and served as art director, with help from Tony Bell. Around February 1968, Gary and Gilbert left for San Francisco, and Jim Franklin moved in upstairs and took over. In the spring of 1969, an officer from the APD Vice Squad came in to talk with me. I'd known Jerry Spain since I was a kid. I'd even mowed his yard and babysat for him. He told me that there was tremendous pressure on APD to shut the Vulcan down. They were aware that my name was on all the permits, that I was putting up the money to keep the place going. If you don't stop, he said, half a pound of pot will be planted in your office, and you'll do 15 to 25 in Huntsville. I thanked him for the tip and gave him assurances, then sold my house and left town. The truth was that from 1967 to 1969, certain people I knew from California, particularly Terry the Tramp, Owlsy Stanley, Melissa, and Mountain Girl, had a tremendous influence on Austin music. The fees for all those Chicago blues legends and cult favorites like the Fugs and the Velvet Underground, not to mention our utility bills and other mundane expenses, were supported by sales of LSD. If people in Austin had not enjoyed getting high and expanding their consciousness, the Vulcan wouldn't have lasted more than a couple of weeks. Somehow the Vulcan limped along until the spring of 1970. A few months after it closed, Armadillo World Headquarters opened, things changed. There were a couple of long hairs on the city council. The people at the Armadillo were able to bridge the gap between the old Austin Longhairs and the redneck Peckerwoods. Austin was on its way to becoming the live music capital of the world. That's the end of Don Hyde's letter, and Eddie picks back up. The brave souls who took over the helm at the Vulcan after Don Hyde's departure attempted to establish a music and arts joint that wasn't reliant on beer sales for financial stability, and they failed. That didn't stop me from wanting to give it another shot. Spencer Perskin wanted me to consider taking over the Vulcan. I'd been there once before, not to see a band, but to warn Houston White about the determination of local law enforcement to shut them down. It was an awkward experience. Back then, I was working for the Brewers Association, and had come straight from a meeting of the Disciplinary Control Board. That's where I had heard military police officials talk about working with the Austin Police Department to raid that hippie joint and put them out of business. So immediately after leaving the meeting, I drove over there. Visiting the place during daylight hours was not for the faint-hearted. Once upon a time, the storefront windows had displayed samples of footwear that was sold within. The same windows now showed off Jim Franklin's shock art. Toilets with mannequin body parts protruding from bowls and tanks. Another mannequin dressed in military garb, lying there as if mortally wounded. Stepping around a pile of trash at the entrance, I saw a wine bottle with a hypodermic syringe inside. There was a group of eight or so guys, long-haired, wearing scruffy t-shirts and jeans. They began backing away as I entered. My suit and tie spelled C-O-P, I reckoned. I asked for Houston White. No response. I'm just trying to get word to him that there's a bust coming down, I said. Still nothing. It was wasted breath. Two of the suspicious, mutely hostile hippies in the group turned out to be Don Hyde and Bobby Hederman, who later became close friends of mine. The Austin underground scene could be a tough nut to crack. The terrible thing was that Austin hippies were hoping that another place just like the Vulcan would arise to take its place. In view of my experiences there, this was going to be a difficult ask. My writer friend, Edwin Bud Schrake, who had made himself so indispensable to his bosses at Sports Illustrated that they let him live in Austin, gave me a check for $1,000 to try and save the Vulcan. So I went back there again to give it another look. On this trip, I learned that the toilets in the front window had been removed from the restrooms, which were non-functioning. As the son of a plumber, I knew then that saving the Vulcan was beyond our grasp. It was a dump beyond redemption. For the time being, Austin hippie bands like Shiva's were making do with another dive, just south of the Colorado River town-lake divide, called the Cactus Club. On that fateful night, in July 1970, I went there with Spencer Perskin to see some friends play in a band called the Hub City Movers. Spencer brought along his violin so he could jam with them, and he brought me to show his hippie friends that I was cool, that he trusted me, which was nice since not even the other members of Shiva's trusted me. The Cactus was one of three bars at the corner of Barton Springs Road and Barton and Riverside Drive, a short block off Congress Avenue, the city's main street. The other two bars were La Fuentes and the Squirrel's Inn. All three were classic Texas beer joint shacks. As a potential alternative to the Vulcan, the Cactus had little to recommend itself. Instead of an elevated stage, the bandstand was the lowest part of the room. The ceiling was low, the tables wobbly, dinette chairs squawked against the concrete floor. Then, when moved, there was no ventilation and the beer was warm. But next to the Cactus was a building complex that featured a two-story structure with a Quonset-styled arched roof and a skating rink called the Skating Palace. Shuttered, dusty, and dormant, these big empty spaces sat there, so obvious that they were invisible. Bringing the story back to plumbing again, I might never have noticed them myself if the Cactus had better restrooms. Ha! All right, I'm going to stop with the readings for today there. There's quite a few more selections, and maybe I'll just do them tomorrow. Here, Bud Schrake appears at the end. He's got a Sports Illustrated job, I guess, in his history. He's done his years in New York and come back to Texas. And Eddie is working for the Brewers Association, wears a coat and tie every day to work. Becomes manager of Shiva's Headband. And the ask is, find us a place to play. And the Vulcan Gas Company on Congress has closed. They've literally chased Don Hyde out of town. They have shut him down. The police have let him know that if you don't shut this place down, we will plant drugs on you and throw you in prison for more than a decade. And so there isn't a club that they love. And what Eddie mentions there about plumbing is, as the story goes, on that night, he wanders outside to take a leak, and he's leaning against this big building, and he goes wandering in through the fence and looks inside this former National Guard armory space, and that becomes the Armadillo World headquarters. And in that space, Willie stands in front of the crowd in August of 72 and decides this is where it's all happening. and comes back to Texas and brings Waylon, and that begins the ball rolling. This is all, of course, part of the recent history here, and just one particular tiny little strand related to one sort of set of genres of music and how those artists' careers evolved and all of this. It's not the theoretically bigger pieces of banking and finance and you know, the segregationist history of Austin and some of these things that are weightier and arguably more important. It's all on my mind these days. We're in a best of times, worst of times period. Again, maybe like always, there's a tremendous amount of change happening, technology and social and cultural and financial and the macro and micro. And here we all are. We get up every day. Talked a lot in these about getting after it, learning new things. I need to spend a lot more time on startups and entrepreneurship and all kinds of stuff. But dipping momentarily back into Austin history, I guess, tugged by bookending these last few with a Threadgill's auction. Like, literally all that just going away. And so hoping to light up some of it in my own mind and in your minds and our hearts so that we can know about it a little more. And again, those whispers of better get busy and hey, this could be you, hopefully calling out. I do think tomorrow I will pick up right here and read a little bit more of these Texas things about these artists, entrepreneurs seeking their own sustainability so they can develop their voice. Thanks, y'all.